open the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue. We will go Senate Bill 416, Senator Walker's here, so we'll do that bill first, then we'll do Senate Bill 39, and then we'll do Senate Bill 38. Open a work session on Senate Bill 416. Senator Walker, you've been working on this issue, brought it to our attention, certainly had the committee concerned about some of the issues you raised, and I think I've been working with several groups to get these amendments before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. I appreciate you taking this bill first because I'm actually chairing a committee next door that I need to scoot back to. This was a simple little bill, and I have a knack for turning a simple little bill into something a little more than that. You have five amendments in front of you, and let me just go through those and tell you who the authors are, and then I'll lay out my amendments, and then I'm just going to leave the room and let you duke it out and decide what you want to do.
Thank you.
So the Dash 1 amendment's the City of Portland, and so I'll let them address their own amendments. The Dash 2, 3, and 4 are mine, and the Dash 5 comes from John Tess, and they can address their amendments. I think their Dash 5 is similar to my Dash 4. They simply set up a task force, and I simply direct the department to do certain things. So let me take, if I can, my amendments. And these, I met with a small group that was involved in this, and we've talked on the phone. They've been in my office. We met as a group. And I met with you and Senator Monroe and tried to get a handle on this. And fortunately, when we were trapped on the Senate floor the other day for 2 hours, we were able to find some time together and pull up legislative counsel and figure out particularly the Dash 3s, because the Dash 3 is really in response to some of the concerns that you wanted me to address, as well as Senator Monroe. So Dash 2, let's take Dash 2. This is the one I said that if I was going to add back that second 15-year extension, I wanted some sideboards around it, because, frankly, just granting someone a second 15-year extension because they didn't get it all done in the first 15 years, I didn't think was appropriate. So we've added back the commercial. I agree that the commercial properties need both the first 15 years and the second 15 years. They have to meet a pretty high bar. There's seismic upgrades and ADA things, things of that nature. And I heard pretty compelling evidence that that was important. But I was not as compelled by the evidence on the residential. So I said, I want some more sideboards. If you're going to grant a second 15-year extension to these residential properties, then I want to see some more work. So the Dash 2 will show that on page 1, you'll see in bold there, the preservation plan must include a schedule for completion of substantial rehabilitation work on the exterior of the building within the first 5 years of the special assessment period. That's in the first 15 year, because I think it's important that we see more than just standard routine maintenance. Just simply putting a roof on and painting, we all do that. We all do that to our homes. As I mentioned, I'm getting a roof on my home, and the bid's now up to about $7,000 on just a small ranch home, and I'm not getting a tax break for that. So we just thought they needed to show a little bit more for the work that they're going to do. And then on page 4, you will see that a reapplication requires the same extensive work in the first 5 years so that we can see the work that they're doing. So that's pretty much the Dash 2 amendments. The Dash 3s, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so let's take them. Can we do them one at a time and see if anyone has any questions on the Dash 2?
Sure.
For Senator Walker.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Burdick.
I'm sitting here trying to, I don't know if this is relevant to the Dash 2, but the Dash 2 would still make residential property only eligible for one 15-year.
No, okay. No, Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, it makes them eligible for both. And the requirement is that their plan must have the major rehabilitation work in the first 5 years in both the first 15-year and the second 15-year. And that's on page 4 for the second 15 year.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Dash 3s.
Excuse me. I'm still fighting this cold. The dash 3s, you're going to get a lot of pushback on that one. Because people think that they should be able to renovate their properties no matter what their income level or neighborhood that they live in. And I did review all of the properties around the state, and there are some lower income properties that have applied for this status, and especially in some of the more rural parts of the state. I think the concern I heard in the committee and the concern that I expressed were things like places in the Dunthorpe neighborhood in Portland. That is a very wealthy neighborhood, and clearly you would be doing something to that home because your neighborhood association wouldn't let you get away with not doing something to that home. And so I have inserted in here some suggested language that came to us, and that language is on page 2, lines 27. A governing body may exclude certain districts or properties from participation in the special assessment program under criteria established by the governing body. In adopting criteria, the governing body shall consider whether a district is in economic distress and the value of the property in the district. I thought that was an odd sentence, and I was going to talk to Ms. Hunt about it this morning, but the point of that is it does set up another layer of bureaucracy, according to some of the users of the system, but that does give cities and counties more flexibility to decide whether they want to open up a particular neighborhood to these tax benefits. So that, Mr. Chair, is the dash 3. Do you have any questions on that one?
Questions on the dash 3, Senator Monroe.
Well, I think this does exactly what I suggested. It, first of all, gives all of the authority to the local government, to the jurisdiction, and it simply allows them to apply some additional sideboards that make this program make more sense. Nobody likes to see their very wealthy neighbor with a very wealthy piece of property not pay his or her property tax when they're paying their full boat. So I think this would allow the city of Portland in this case or other cities to look at the program and determine whether or not it's necessary for the preservation of these valuable properties.
Yeah, it does seem to be to give them the option, but doesn't mandate that they exclude a certain property. They just are given the option the way it's drafted.
That's exactly right, Mr. Chair. And if you recall, I was really struggling with this one. I just couldn't get my arms around this concept. And so we had several meetings, you and I, and finally had that visitation with the Legislative Council on the floor. And that was really what we felt was going to work the most. And it is. It's optional. And it still allows communities to participate in the historic preservation program, but it also allows them to put a little bit more of their own sideboards around whether this particular district or area in their community needs the additional tax break. But you will get a lot of pushback on that one. I'll let you know that right now.
You know, with a May?
Well, I think so. The people like, as I said yesterday, people are in love with their tax breaks, Mr. Chair. It's an addictive thing. It's very hard to break the habit. I think we need a little bit of methadone in the legislature to wean people off of some of their tax breaks because I just think we're too busy writing the blank checks. However, I do like the historic preservation program. I do think it works. It just needs some help. Because there, in Eugene, for instance, we've lost so many of our historical properties because of urban renewal. They tore them all down, and it's a shame. And I love going to places like Baker City that is just an incredible display of history. And now the Hot Lake Hotel property has been purchased and is being renovated and turned into something beautiful that it once was, and I'm very, very excited about that. And that property was on the rolls and then went off, and now the new owner is is very much interested in restoring the property to its grandeur. So let me take you to the Dash 4. The Dash 4 I really like as well. That is my amendment, and it directs the department to come up with recommendations for improving or eliminating the program. As you know, this program sunsets in 2010, so we're going to go through this again in 2009 because they're going to want to re-up the program. I'm not interested in re-upping a program that hasn't had a thorough review, so I've the department helped me come up with some ideas to come up to present to you, and that's the Dash 4. And it also requires them to look at whether this should go to a tax credit program instead of the sort of program, offset program that it is now. The Dash 4, or the Dash 5, Mr. Tess has, and he sets up a task force to do a similar thing. I'm not a big fond of task forces. I think the department can do it itself. They can open it up for all kinds of review and have hearings, and they know they're under the microscope here. So I'll do it either way. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, those are my amendments. If you, unless you have any questions, I have to scoot back and chair my committee.
Senator Burke.
I'm going to be asking the City of Portland what they think of your amendments, and I'd like to ask you what you think of the City of Portland amendments, specifically restricting residential properties to that one 15-year term.
Mr. Chair and Senator Burdick, I became convinced that it was important to the integrity of the program, and particularly for some of the rural communities and some of the smaller cities that have these kinds of properties and people who don't have a lot of money, to be able to utilize the second 15-year. I became convinced that that was important, but I wasn't convinced that we were going to give it to them without some additional sideboards. And those, they're pretty minimal, the Dash 2, but it's enough to make me happy for the moment and pending a greater review of the program.
Thank you. Thank you for your work on this.
You're welcome. It took a lot more time. I thought this was going to be a simple little fix to what I thought was an egregious problem, and it turned out it wasn't as egregious as I thought, but it still needed some work, and I'll be glad to get this one behind me.
I know you worked hard. Any other questions for Senator Walker? So you are advocating most for the Dash 2, Dash 3, and Dash 4.
Correct.
And the Dash 1 is the City of Portland, so we'll have up next.
Correct.
Thank you.
All right.
Enjoy
thank
your
you,
committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
City of Portland. And is there anyone else, if you could wave, that fills on this? Are you just waving, Christina, or do you want to come up and?
I'm five.
You want? There is? Okay. I didn't know there was fives. Okay. You'll come up next and talk about the fives. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Deckard. Dan Bates, City of Portland, Director of Government Relations. I have with me today Bob Clay, City's Supervising Planner, and Nicholas Starn, who is the City Planner that deals with these issues, and any kind of technical question was probably best answered by them. And a point of clarification on the Dash 1, we wrote that anticipating the senator's bill that would eliminate the residential. The city's actually neutral on elimination of the residential. We have decided not to continue the second 15 on our own residential for some of the concerns that you've heard about. And there's a report that the Planning Bureau put together that analyzed some of those concerns. And so if the decision was to continue the second 15 on the residential with local control, we're fine with that. In fact, that's why we offered the one, is to move that local control as well to the commercial property. As you'll find from our analysis, the commercial is incredibly beneficial to the City of Portland, to historic preservation, and the second 15 is often necessary to make those projects work. And what we would like to have is that same local control, so that in the future, if those dynamics change, we'd have the ability to go back and take a look at it and ask ourselves whether that program still makes sense for the City of Portland. So that's the analysis behind our amendment. We think that local control is important for the same reasons that we found it true in residential, although we at this point find the benefits on commercial. We're happy to answer any particular questions.
And who's with you?
This is Nicholas Starin, who is a city planner, and Bob Clay, who's a supervising planner with the City of Portland.
Mr. Clay. Questions for the City of Portland, especially as related to the Dash 1s.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Monroe.
So does the Dash 1, would the Dash 1 eliminate the possibility of other jurisdictions granting a second 15-year on residential?
As presently written, it would. To move the commercial to a local control, we would need to write it so that it would be residential or commercial. It was written as Senator Walker's bill was anticipating, so we would need to redraft that particular component if we wanted to keep the residential on there.
Have other cities been consulted on the Dash 1s?
We've spoken with the league, so we understand some local communities like it and in no way are trying to change that. So we would actually advocate changing it if the committee wants to keep the residential in local control.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
I think I'd like to go the direction that Senator Walker suggested. Put some sideboards on the second 15 as in her, what was it, the Dash 3 amendments. But allow local jurisdictions other than the City of Portland who want to grant that second 15 years under certain circumstances to have that right, that ability. Mm-hmm. So does that mean we have to go back to LC and get this drafted again?
If we want to adopt, many of these amendments are obviously the ones I'm most familiar with are the ones that Senator Walker, so the Dash 2, 3, and 4, the ones and then the fives are somewhat new. But if we wanted to adopt the ones, we couldn't accommodate both.
Well, I definitely think we need to keep commercial, out of this bill or out of the restrictions. Commercial is where most of the work is done, most of the important work, and so I support that part of the Dash 1 amendment.
Other questions or thoughts for the City of Portland?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Burdick.
I'd like to get, first of all, it's my understanding, and I've got all these amendments flying around, that if 2, 3, and 4 are adopted, I think, wouldn't it be a local option for both commercial and residential?
Chair Decker, Senator Burdick, my understanding is right now there is not a local option for commercial. And so if 2, 3, and 4 were adopted, it would maintain the no local control on commercial. If it were passed, and so there would remain local control on the residential, but not on commercial.
Oh, yeah. I think that would be a positive addition to the Walker amendments. If that addition were made, then you would have no need for your Dash 1. Is that correct?
Senator Burke, that's correct. If we can make it so that there was a commercial local control on the other amendments, we would not need the Dash 1.
Okay, and then to follow up, Mr. Chair, I'd like your specific comment giving you the authority on the Dash 3 amendments to consider other factors like the Dunthorpe factor in your decision-making. I wanted to get your opinion on that.
Chair Decker, Senator Burdick, we just saw the amendment for the first time yesterday, obviously had the discussion, the larger discussion about this type of ideas. Our own commission has asked itself the question, how would we go about doing things like this to try and find the sideboards? And they are not clear on how you would actually set that criteria. So we'd want to spend some time thinking through, is that practicable? And how do we actually make that work and accomplish the ends? So there are some concerns in terms of the feasibility of actually getting it accomplished and getting a criteria correct. But we've just taken a look at that and would reserve judgment.
But Mr. Chair, since it's optional, it really wouldn't do any harm, would it? I mean, you wouldn't oppose a bill that had that in it?
Chair Decker, Senator Burke, since we haven't decided to extend the second 15 on residential, and I'm not clear whether or not the Dash 3 would apply to both the first 15 and the second 15, if it applied just the second 15, it wouldn't affect us.
Thank you.
Just for clarity, the Dash 3 just says may exclude. So it would just say you guys could take a look at these two things. If you still wanted to go forward, you could. But we would hope at the state level that you'd take a look at the value of the property in the district, and is it in economic distress?
Chairman Deckard, you'll find in the report that we raised some of those same concerns in not implementing the second 15. We're just unclear exactly of how we would accomplish those goals, even in a May situation. We would have some hard work to do to figure out how to accomplish that in meeting all those goals, but we recognize those concerns.
Great. Other thoughts?
Well, Mr. Chair, that's good news, and sounds like if we can include the 2, 3, and 4, and maybe we can move this bill today.
That's kind of where I'm leaning. I want to hear about the dash 5 since, yes, Stan.
Chairman Decker, we would also be supportive of the dash 5 and taking a comprehensive look at this.
Another task force.
Mr. Chair.
Who wants to be on it? Senator Burdick.
I agree in concept with Senator Monroe, but I would like that commercial piece to have a local option on it. Senator Monroe, would you object to that?
Sure. But I think you have to have something else drafted to do that. Mm-hmm. Don't they already have that authority?
It's local option now, isn't it?
Not for commercial. Chair Deckard, Senator Monroe, not for the commercial.
Commercial, okay. Yeah.
And that was kind of the intent of the original bill, was getting at some of those questions.
Because I really think, you know, there's a good policy rationale. I mean, right now the policy clearly indicates that it's in the city's interest to extend it for commercial, but situations sometimes change, and I think those decisions could be best made at the local level. And it'd be nice to have them have the authority to do it.
That would need to be drafted if we're going to do that.
I'll volunteer to do that if you would like.
Please, then we. I guess the ramification is we would not move this bill today, which I think would please many in the audience. So.
No, you know, I don't. It could also be done in the House if it went over there. I just think there's a good argument to be made for it. So
providing the
there's a lot of work that's gone into this bill. If you think it would jeopardize the bill to hold it up,
I don't think it would jeopardize it. Okay. Other questions or thoughts?
Mr. Chair, I would support Senator Burdick, but it's your call. If you want to move the bill today, we can get that fixed in the House, or if you want to wait and let Senator Burdick get that amendment clarification, then we can move it next week.
Senator Starr or Senator George, although we're going to hear from one more group, any?
I'm fine with moving the bill today, Mr. Chair.
Senator George, do you?
Either way.
Either way. Okay. Thank you very much. Christina.
It's just way down there.
It is. good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, I'm Christina McNitt, and I represent a group called the Cultural Advocacy Coalition. And the person that we had here at the last hearing was John Tess, who comes from my work group, the Heritage Advisory Group, co-chaired by Barbara Sidway from Baker City and Mary Oberst here in town. I think what you've just heard is that a number of the conversations that have been provoked by the hard work that's gone into this bill have demonstrated to all of us and the stakeholders that the old adage, when you pick a flower, you disturb a star. And this is a very successful program, but it doesn't, it's not perfect. We recognize that. And we think that it would benefit from some thorough review during the interim. It has a sunset for 2010 anyway, and we developed the Dash 5 amendments, which are very similar to the Dash 4s, but prescribes who's on the committee and lays out a couple other questions for consideration. Excuse me, but thinking that it would be appropriate to have a solid review with recommendations for legislative changes or extension or repeal of the sunset in the next session.
So the natural question is, we hate task forces. I understand the 2010, and maybe you just have to have one because you're going to have to report back to the interim revenue committees in the legislature next time.
Mr. Chair, I recognize that you hate task force, and I think you shared that with me in your office when we talked about it previously. But we really couldn't come to agreement around the table. And this is a very important program to a lot of communities for residential properties and for commercial properties. And quite frankly, it's not a perfect program, but it has been around since the 70s. It's a huge economic driver in some communities. And we would want to make sure that any changes that we did now in the short term wouldn't adversely or negatively affect the program when it's up for review in 2010 anyway, or a sunset. So we just suggest that it might be very appropriate for the legislature, and there's only one member of the House and the Senate that would be on the task force. It's prescribed in Section 1. But we just wanted to make sure there was a large group of people that would be considering the program, including a representative from the National Trust for Historic Preservation, the State Historic Preservation Office, the Oregon Preservation Alliance, the Oregon Historical Property Owners Association, developers within urban and rural areas, the Oregon State Association of County Assessors, the Department of Revenue, the League of Cities, and some homeowners. We have not had the ability to have that broad of a group of people discuss either Senate Bill 416 or the other amendments before you, and just feel that since the program affects them, that it would be important to have a holistic conversation.
Right. That's makes sense, and task force is not aren't always just that, a task force. Questions for Ms. McNett?
Sure, sir. It seems to me that the amendments presented by Senator Walker basically asking the department to do the same thing the task force is doing. Why not just let the department put together the task force outside of a bill specified legislative initiative? What's wrong with that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Starr, that is one way to go. And if I know none of us have really had a chance to look at the amendments because they all came out last night. But you'll see there's not a lot of difference except for prescribing who's on the task force. And I guess I would just suggest to you that it provides a level of confidence to my clients that there would be a broad number of stakeholders providing input to the department. Not that that wouldn't necessarily occur, but it's just a level of assurance.
Okay, we're getting signals from the audience. Come on, yeah, please. Good morning.
Good morning. Roger Roper, Assistant Director for Heritage Programs at Parks and Recreation, and we're the ones who administer this program. And I just wanted to clarify a couple of points, and first addressing the Dash 5 amendment. Either 4 or 5 we're comfortable with, and I just want to assure everyone that we expect, if it's the Dash 4 amendment, we would reach out to all the sorts of folks that are referenced explicitly in the Dash 5, but either one is fine with us.
Go ahead.
I did want to clarify a couple of points, too, regarding the Dash 3 amendment. And I think what triggered the Dash 3 is the concern. Well, it was really the Oregonian article that pointed out specific properties in Portland, the Dunthorpe properties and others. As we really researched that, those were the most extreme examples, and they were from a time from the early 90s. All of those projects that were highlighted in the article came onto the program in the early 90s before a preservation plan was required. So they came on before many of the sideboards that are in place now were part of the program. So we think that article exposes the program, but not the way it used to be, perhaps, but not the way it is now. And so it may be, anyway, just to let you know that none of the projects that were highlighted are recent projects at all. The other concern we've heard regarding the Dash 3 is the hassle factor for applicants to have to deal with two levels of government on every application and be subject to perhaps the whims of a local jurisdiction that doesn't really understand the nuances of what's really a pretty technical program. And so some of the property owners have expressed that sort of concern that they're going to be getting the runaround and running from state to local just to get an approval.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, the problem with that argument, though, is that when the local jurisdiction and the state or whoever decides to take property off the rolls or take substantial wealth off the rolls, it does hurt the bottom line for the local jurisdiction and the things that it's funding with property taxes. So it seems to me that it's appropriate for them to have a role.
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, they currently are given a role to comment on every application. As the county assessor is also given a chance to comment on every application. We don't get many comments back, but every once in a while we do. So there is a mechanism in place already for some scrutiny at the local level. It's not to this extent.
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, this is tangential to your comment, but it's also something, again, picking the flower and disturbing the star. What we're discovering is on the 15-year opportunity for extension on residentials, the homes have to come off from their special assessment. They're revalued before they can go back on for their next 15 years, and our homeowners are finding that their property values are actually higher when they're revalued than if they hadn't even participated in the program to begin with. So we have some significant issues in this whole program that we really, really do need to get our hands around, and hopefully we can do that in a task force during the interim.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? So I guess the only do the dash fours give you that task force? It sounds like the Parks Department is going to do something to assemble a like group without the dash fives. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Christina, does that give you solace, or you'd like it in statute?
Well, we'd prefer it in statute. That's why we drafted the dash fives, but we're not opposed to the dash fours. We are opposed to the dash one, or the ones, twos, and threes, just because we'd like to go through the task force and do the evaluation first and then come back with some proposals that the stakeholders have all agreed on.
Thank you. Thank you. Anyone else? Phil? Great. So I think the dash twos, threes, and fours, and if the committee wants to do the fives, I'm fine.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I'll move the dash two amendments.
Senator Monroe has moved the dash two amendments. Discussion. Objections to that motion. Senator Starr objects.
Chair.
Senator Monroe.
Move the dash three amendment.
Senator Monroe has moved the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 416. Discussion. Objections. Senator Starr is objected twice now. Senator Monroe.
Move the dash four amendments.
Senator Monroe has moved the dash four amendments to Senate Bill 416. Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I'm prepared to move dash five. I don't know what you want to do about that.
I'm fine with them.
We're going to merge the two.
I think if we have to choose between the dash four and the dash five, I personally would prefer the dash four. I don't think we need a statutory setup for this. I think we do need an analysis, but not a statutory setup. So I will be objecting. I will be supporting the dash fours, but objecting to the dash five.
That's where I am too.
Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, I think that this is an issue of such significance because, as I said in our earlier testimony on this bill, I'm scared to death of what I'm seeing as far as a loss of historic preservation in this state. And it just seems to be a systematic undermining of historic properties, and anything we can do to preserve that, and a group that would be looking at this very holistically and saying, okay, we know we have a deadline on 2010. Let's see if we can come up with a plan for Oregon. I think would be a very wise move.
I'm fine with the dash fives. I think you get the same. They're pretty similar. One just gives you, I guess, more. And the First Lady did at least contact me in the last 2 days asking for this formal task force.
In the statute?
In the statute.
Okay, so then we should, and I'll go along with the chair on that. Yeah, that's what
has the dash four been moved? Have we moved the dash four?
I'll withdraw my motion on the dash four, And Senator George can move the dash 5.
Senator George.
Right. Move the dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 416.
Senator George has moved the dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 416. Discussion of that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I'm going to support the dash 5 amendments. I didn't support the other amendments because I think that we're getting the cart before the horse. I think we need to have the task force before we amend the program. You know, I think that if we're going to amend the program, let's do that. And then forget the task force, because we need the task force for it, because we just decided how we're going to change the program. So I that's why I oppose the other amendments. I think that the task force, whether, and I don't care really whether it's the dash 5s or the dash 4s, but let's look at the program, let's see what works and what doesn't, let's get everybody around the table, you know, and figure that out. And I think that's the appropriate way to move forward on this. So.
Definitely understandable. This issue does come up, I think, in the early testimony on 416. One of the proponents testified that this program is reviewed every 2 years, and that's been certainly my experience, is that every 2 years historic preservation is before at least one committee. That's, I guess, I hope I'm not the one appointed to the task force. I feel like I have run the circuit on this, on historic preservation. Other thoughts on, have we moved the dash 5s?
Yeah, Senator George moved the dash 5.
Other thoughts on the dash 5s? Objections to the dash 5s? So ordered. Who wants to move the bill?
Do you want to wait for Jenny Burdick's amendment, or?
I will. I'm always of the inclination to move when we can, but I am more than happy to, if we want to wait and have Senator Burdick draft an amendment, we can do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We will close the work session on Senate Bill 416 and open a work session on Senate Bill 39.
Yes.
Senator Monroe.
You have before you amendments, dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 39, and essentially, why don't I let Chris explain to you?
Okay, Chris, so we've had a work group. Senator,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, at your direction, Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe chaired a work group that looked at the original drafting of Senate Bill 39. And the first cut of that work group is what's contained in the dash 2 amendments. And last time, or about a week ago, I think we briefly touched on what those amendments would be. We now have the amendments back from Ledge Council. And in summary, what the bill now does is it defines listed transactions and reportable transactions. Listed transactions are tied to the federal listed transactions, as well as including certain transactions related to REITs and RICs that contain no that lack economic substance. The bill also requires that taxpayers who engage in or are associated with or receive a tax benefit from a reportable transaction report that transaction to the Department of Revenue, beginning with tax year 2007. And failing to report that transaction creates a penalty. That's a new penalty that's created by the bill. The bill also simplified the penalty structure and simply creates a 60% penalty for the understatement of tax due to the use of a listed transaction. And the penalty applies to listed transactions discovered or reported on or after January 1, 2008. Also, the bill creates a 100% penalty for promoters of a tax shelter, and it opens closed tax years going back to 1999. Now, one of the related effect that the work group discussed is that the Department of Revenue is planning on conducting an administrative voluntary compliance initiative this spring or summer, in conjunction with the Multi-State Tax Commission and about 30 other states. So one of the things that was discussed was how the initial VCI in 39 would interact with that. And the upshot of that was the dash 2 amendments that you have here, and so the timed VCI is no longer in the bill. but rather these penalties are created. They're additional tools that would help enhance the response to the administrative VCI. So basically, with the 60% penalty that kicks in for transactions reported or discovered after January 1, 2008, there's this, the remainder of 2007 for taxpayers to come forward and refile their tax returns and pay the appropriate amount of tax, pulling out the listed transactions and not incur any of these penalties. But if we get to January 1, 2008, then these penalties kick in.
Yeah, so, Mr. Chair, in lieu of a tax amnesty, then, what we do is we increase the penalties after a period of time for clearly illegal transactions. We have cut out of this bill any so-called gray areas. And some of the supporters, I know Jody, wished we'd gone farther. But what we're doing is we're taking the federal listed transactions, which are listed as illegal transactions, and we're adding to that the writs and the REITs only if they are for no other purpose but to avoid taxes. And then we're setting some penalties as stated, and also you'll notice the penalties in Section 9, the $3,300, $16,700, $33,000, $66,000. You might wonder where we got those numbers. Those are one-third of what the federal penalties are for those same kinds of activities. Since, generally speaking, Oregon state income tax rate is approximately one-third of the federal tax rate. That's where we got those numbers. And so my understanding is that Mr. Martinez still has a concern about these amendments. I'm not sure exactly what that is, but as far as I'm concerned, it seems that these amendments do what the task force has asked. Representative Tom Butler was at every task force meeting.
Who else was on the task force?
It wasn't a task force. We had a number of people that came in from time to time, but Representative Butler and I were the only legislators that were there at every meeting. Representative McPherson came in for one meeting for a time.
Mm-hmm. So this is similar to the bill that obviously passed the Senate, I believe, unanimously last legislative session. Tim, do you want to come up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. To my left is Bill Manny, a partner at Miller Nash. I'm going to let him talk the details because he is the tax expert at the table. But I would like to make a couple of comments. First of all, I want to thank Senator Monroe for letting us join whatever you want to call it, the group that met to discuss this this issue. We were there only one time. We were brought in rather late into the process, but we do appreciate the fact that we were brought into the process. And you know, Bill is going to talk about some of the concerns that remain, and it's primarily in the drafting of the amendments. Bill has spent the last 24 hours, because as you know, Mr. Chair, these amendments first came out late on Tuesday, and then the second set of amendments came out late on Wednesday, and due to the health of one of your members, it's been difficult to sit down and discuss with him prior to this morning our concerns. So our preference would be, and it's not in a delaying manner, our preference would be that we get a chance to get these amendments redrafted in a way that everybody can agree to. To that end, Bill has been meeting and talking with the Department of Revenue, and I think even this morning with your revenue staff on some of the concerns that we have, and I think we're pretty close to, if not there, subject to the language, and that's kind of what happened the last time, last week. But subject to the language, I think we're close. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and if not, I would turn it over to Bill to kind of talk about the issues that we see remaining.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have 5 points, four of which we discussed with the Department of Revenue and Revenue staff, and I think we're okay on them. Two are simple changes in language, and two would require modifications for language that I think we would prefer to review the revised language. And all of these comments relate to addressing the specific and only the specific abuses that Senator Munro referenced, in essence narrowing, narrowly focusing on what those things are. In the Dash 2 amendment, the definition of a transaction without economic substance currently says includes but is not limited to a transaction for which the taxpayer cannot demonstrate a business purpose other than tax savings. We would request the deletion of the words includes but is not limited to. It should simply be, as Senator said, a transaction for which the taxpayer cannot demonstrate a business purpose other than tax savings. Similarly, there continues in sub D of section 2 a...
Can we take these one at a time?
Sure.
Can you point to us on a line number on the amendment that you're referring to?
On the amendment, it's line 8. Now, I only have dash 1 in front of me. I don't have a printed copy of the dash 2, but I think it should be in the same place.
Sure. Mr. Chair, I happen to have an extra copy of the dash 2 here. That would help.
Feel free to pass it to your left if some... And Paul, if you, since you worked this issue last session, it'd be good to have, if this is any different than the bill that was worked on last session, it'd be good to know that made it out of the House Revenue Committee as of last session. It'd be helpful to know any differences that are now coming up.
Well, perhaps I can note that it's very different because all the voluntary compliance is gone. So all that's happening with this bill is we're instituting additional penalties and specifying things that are bad things that will be subject to those penalties and subject to an expanded statute of limitations.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if I could add, I think it is important for the committee to realize this what you have before you, these amendments before you, are no longer a VCI bill. I think the direction that the committee is going, at least as far as the work group is concerned, is that the state will participate in this national voluntary VCI bill, and we're just giving the department additional, you're just giving the department additional powers to collect certain taxes.
So the language I was referring to is on lines 8 and 9 of the Dash 2 amendment. And again, it is the words that starts transaction without economic substance, and we would suggest deleting includes but is not limited to, inserting the word means, so that it would read a transaction without economic substance means or is a transaction for which the taxpayer cannot demonstrate a business purpose other than tax savings. I don't know if there are any. Should I move on to the next point?
I'd just like to know if the department has any anything to say about that change, whether that wording is necessary for their work. Or
I assume that you did bring this up in the work group when this issue was discussed. Deborah, you can sit if you're willing to.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Senator Munro, we did discuss that this morning. I did check with the program before this hearing, and they are comfortable in that change if the committee desires to make it.
Okay, fine.
Thank you.
Good.
Yes. Move on.
Thanks.
The other is not in the amendment. It is in the bill itself because it is not modified, but is in Section 2.1. Small d, right before section sub 2 of section 2, and it says a transaction that is substantially similar to a transaction described in paragraphs A and C. And in the work group, I thought there was agreement that we were simply going to limit the bill to listed transactions that are defined by the federal government, reportable transactions defined by the federal government, and REITs and RICs that lacked economic substance. And Section D would give the department much broader authority to come up with anything that they may view as substantially similar. And again, I think we discussed this morning, and there's general agreement with that change.
Mr. Chairman, Deborah Buchan, and yes, that was my understanding in the work group as well, is that we were talking specifically federal listed transactions, the two state identified transactions that are detailed here, and no more than that. So the department would be comfortable if the committee wishes to make that change.
Did this come up in the work group, these issues?
Mr. Chair, I'll be the bad guy. I think what has happened is it's very difficult. This is very technical language. And to expect legislative counsel to perhaps get it right the first time without having some modifications in the short time frame that they have or working under today was difficult. So that was the point of my opening comments. We think we're really close here, but it's just the language that's causing us some issues, and we think with a day or two we could get those issues, get it finalized, and get it to legislative counsel in the manner that we all agree on.
Move on,
please.
No, I don't have a handy reference to this, and we get more conceptual in these next two comments. There is an extension of the statute of limitations, and it is referenced in dash 2 at line 24 of page 2, where 6 is changed to 9. Allowing the department to go back 9 years on the kinds of transactions we are talking about. However, the language of the bill is not specific and would tend to allow the entire tax return of the taxpayer to be opened or remain open for not only assessment, but for the taxpayer to claim refunds back to those 9 years if, for example, they had a listed transaction in their tax return. And we believe the language should specify that the additional statute of limitations is only for the assessment of additional tax, penalty, and interest related to the listed transaction. So if a taxpayer fails to include tax or taxable income related to one of these transactions, the additional statute comes into play. The department has that much additional time to assess the additional tax, penalty, and interest related to that transaction, not to audit the tax return or not to allow the taxpayer to file a refund claim for some other matter.
Mr. Chairman, Deborah Buchanan, and I did talk with Mr. Manning earlier about this. It is purely a policy decision as to whether it opens it or not. It did not occur to me until just now that the other statute that deals with opening closed years when we receive a federal revenue agent report opens that return for all items that are on the return. If we receive a federal report that involves a listed transaction, that is going to open the return for everything. If you wish to have this open the return only for listed transactions, there would be a difference in the treatment depending on whether we have received a federal report or whether the taxpayer has filed the amended return or whether we have discovered it on audit. And so there would be that difference. And if you're fine with that, we are fine with that. We don't have a problem in limiting it that way.
Senator Burke.
What is the statute of limitations for the federal piece of it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, in dealing with listed transactions, I believe there is an extended statute, but I don't know exactly.
I'm thinking it's
it
6 years, but I really couldn't commit to you that I know that is true.
Mr. Chairman. All to you. All shakes his head. Senator Starr.
Thank you. The question I have is, are you okay with moving the statute of limitations back from 6 to 9. Period. Regardless whether
a relative term.
Because that's a pretty significant policy.
I think there is in the bill now there is a retroactive application to tax years of 1999. So in order to have this part of the bill agree to the 1999 year, then that number needs to either be 8 years or 9 years. If it's 8 years, the department would have until March 15th of 2008 to assess additional taxes for 1999 for taxpayers that may have filed those returns timely. And if it's 9 years, they have 15 months until March 15th of 2009 to assess 1999 returns. I think we have some concern that that might allow the department to wait until January 1 to assess 1999 returns with additional taxes and capture the additional penalties that are in this bill. So we would prefer 8 years. We would prefer a retroactive period shorter than 1999. We believe what's really happening here is REITs and RICs are permitted transactions under the federal tax code. What this bill is attempting to address are taxpayers who have abused that structure in order to avoid paying state taxes, and a very well-known, published in the New York Times example of that is Walmart Corporation. It's alleged that Walmart set up REITs and RICs, not having any economic substance really, in order just to avoid state taxes. But what we're doing in this bill is we are making something that was perfectly permissible in 1999, 2000, 2001, 2002, up till 2005, I think, in this state. And we are now making it not okay. And in addition, starting in 2008, we are allowing the department to assess substantial penalties against taxpayers who may have done something that, quite honestly, we can all talk about the morality of it, but it was not technically clear that it was illegal to do in those years. So not really okay with 1999, but if we are going to extend the statute in cases where the federal government has not assessed additional tax for a listed transaction, those would be only state of Oregon listed transactions, which are these REITs and RICs with no economic substance. I believe we should limit the statute to assessing additional tax penalties and interest in connection with that transaction, not creating yet another avenue to open years that were, you know, were filed just years ago to all kinds of additional taxes. And the inverse is also true. I think if you leave the language we have, then you are also opening it for, if a taxpayer has a listed transaction that fits in this definition, then they can also file refund claims on all manner of things because the year would still be open. And I think that's probably something everybody wants to avoid.
So, Deborah, you wanted to get in. My understanding is that these were of questionable, very questionable legality, any of the transactions, and that at least the evidence that I've seen from California. Senator Moreau, you'll have more information.
Yes, and the 1999 is a very important year because that was kind of the end of the bubble, and we think there's a lot of lost money in that year that we need to go recover.
Deborah.
Senator Deckard, Senator Monroe, I believe Senator Monroe characterized it correctly in the beginning that these are transactions that were not legal and not appropriate under the law when they were engaged in. Yes, the federal code does allow REITs and RICs to be set up and structured in certain ways, but it has long been a standard in the law that transactions need to have economic substance to be valid. In 1935, Gregory versus Halvering, you can go back, the U.S. Supreme Court said, yes, you followed the letter of the law, but there was no business purpose and no economic substance to what you did, and invalidated the transaction. So I don't believe it's that you are going back and making legal transactions into illegal transactions. It's that you're saying if you engaged in these and they had no economic substance, you should not have done it. Here's an opportunity to pay tax and interest without incurring a penalty. You may want to avail yourselves of that opportunity.
And I guess the natural question is, why is that a problem?
I don't want to get us derailed here into the difference of opinion about whether they're illegal or not. What we're debating and what I'm requesting is that the statute of limitations be limited to assessing additional tax penalties and interest on these transactions and not creating a way to open all of those tax returns for all purposes, which would include assessing all kinds of other items and allowing the taxpayer to make refund claims. If we're going to go back to 99, let's go back on listed transactions that are violative of this bill when it becomes law. Let's not allow the assessment of all kinds of other additional taxes.
Go, Senator Moreau, and then Deborah.
Deborah, does that make sense to you? Would that be workable, the way he described?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Monroe, having just thought about it a bit more, yes, I think it would be workable. If we receive from the IRS a federal report, that will open the return, and we will make adjustments accordingly. If this is a listed transaction that we have identified, we can administer that by limiting the adjustment to only that transaction. I don't see that there would be a conflict there.
Thank you. Mr. Chair,
please.
First of all, I'd like to apologize for not having this all done clean. I thought our work was finished. Some of these issues that have just come up are issues of questions about the way it was drafted, and I haven't seen these until now, and nobody else has either, or yesterday, and I was sick in bed all day. So I would respectfully suggest that we allow these folks to go ahead and get those amendments drafted as they've outlined, and as Deborah has agreed, and then bring this back next week.
Well, they have two more points. Point three, I at least am not clear. I heard a disagreement. So point one and two seemed clear to me. Point three didn't, and I think you have a couple other.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, can I just address point three just very briefly? To getting back to Senator Starr's question, the 1999 was a key piece. It was in last session's bill. It was a key piece that caused us a lot of concern last session. But I think given some of the discussions that we're having and the direction we're going, it is certainly improving. Would we rather have it be six? Of course we would. And I think that is the key issue here is Mr. Manning and our side clearly believe that most of the things that were done then were indeed legal under the federal tax code. And we're now going to say under Oregon's tax code they weren't, and we're going to collect penalties. Yes, there's a bubble here, and yes, there's some money. But from what we can find, and I don't know whether the department has different numbers, we still don't think it's a very big number. When you get right down to it, and all the expense you're going to have to go through to get that number, and the appeals that will be filed on it, we don't think it's a big number, and I guess I'd be interested in hearing what Department of Revenue thinks that 1999 brings in revenue-wise. And we can do that. We'll have to do that in front of the committee.
Yeah, and although Ms. Buchanan's explanation makes complete sense to me and may sound like we're in disagreement, we're not, I don't think. Ms. Buchanan is explaining how the statutory scheme would work different between federal and state catching the transaction. But I think we're in agreement on limiting the state's right in a state-listed transaction to just assessing additional tax penalty and interest on that transaction. So I don't think we're in disagreement about the change in language that we're requesting on the statute of limitations issue.
Right.
Last is an issue that we did bring up in the work session, and that is the fact that the federal government adds things to listed transactions and takes things off listed transaction lists. And as they assess taxpayers' additional taxes with respect to listed transactions, they sometimes impose the similar penalty to the one we're enacting on the state level, and they sometimes do not impose it. And we would like to see language stating that if the federal government does impose a listed transaction penalty similar to the penalty imposed at the state level and then withdraws it or adjusts it, that the state would follow that withdrawal or adjustment of the similar penalty. So we don't wind up in a situation where on a federally listed transaction we have a different penalty arrangement between the state and federal government. And I thought we discussed that in the work session, and that we were all right with that.
Yeah.
Nod.
Last is just with due respect, Senator Monroe, your assertion and the penalties we now have in here that the federal tax rate is about three times the state tax rate is only a valid statement with respect to individual taxpayers, where the Oregon tax rate is 9% and the federal tax rate can be in the high 30s. With respect to corporations, it's very different, and it's more like a fifth. The Oregon tax rate is much lower, and the corporate tax rate is the same, roughly 39 or 40%. So the Oregon state tax corporate excise tax rate, I believe, is 6.6%. And the federal rate can go as high as 38 or 39. It's more like 20%, not a third.
We could raise it here in Oregon and then fix that.
I'll vote for that, Mr. Chair.
So I guess the fifth point is the consideration of the penalty amounts not being a third of what the federals are, but being somewhere lower. And I don't know if a fifth is right, but there's room between 33% and 20%.
Well, on that one.
I've
got pushback that they're way too low, at least from some of the folks.
I'm happy with the way they are. You know, if you want to carve them down a little bit, that's fine. I think we need substantial penalties. These are illegal activities we're talking about. These are not gray areas. And they're not going to be subject to this penalty if they come clean before next January.
That's all I have.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Anything else, Deborah?
No, sir.
Anyone else? Senate Bill 39.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Brown.
Chris will work with Deborah and Mr. Martinez and get those additional amendments drafted.
1 through 4?
Yeah.
Jody, do you want... You don't have to. You do not have to at all. You can if you would like, but... Okay.
For the record, Jody Weiser with Taxpayers Oregon. I do this with trepidation. But what it feels like has happened here is we have invited the fox to design the hen house. And that's not the way good tax policy is made. This committee last year passed out legislation that was very, very smallly tinkered with. And that legislation was based on the law that was passed in California. What you have before you today has very little to do with that law. There's many things missing. There's an article here by a woman who is a lawyer for Material Advisors. That's the people who design and sell abusive tax shelters and for users of abusive tax shelters. And basically, she scoffs at the law that was passed in Connecticut, which is much stronger than the bill you're talking about passing today. In terms of the penalties, the last issue that Mr. Manley was bringing up, this article points out that one state has the highest penalties of all the states, and theirs are exactly the same as the federal's on that last item of people who did not report listed or reportable transactions. And that is getting noticed. To say, it shouldn't be a third, it should be 20% is crazy. It should be the same as the federal. They've made the same amount of infraction. They have cheated us on our taxes. And they've known that they were playing with the rules and hoping to get by. The reason they are arguing for the shorter period of time is that they don't want to have to decide between now and January whether they're going to report themselves or not. They want to be able to get by without reporting themselves. The graph that shows where the fraud was that was caught by the California amnesty shows that corporations particularly were involved as early as 1997 in ones that were caught, not 1999. And to say we're going to give you until next April That's all the time the department's going to have unless the IRS catches you is crazy, because the IRS isn't looking for the abuses of state tax law. They're looking for abuses of federal tax law. Another point I want to make is that from the beginning, the foxes have not wanted the state to have the power to identify any other abuses. So let's suppose that during the amnesty that's happening in the May through September time with 30 other states, they decide, those states find something new. And they decide they want to act on something new where state taxes were being abused, but federal taxes weren't. What you're saying is, well, our department's going to have to wait till the next time the legislature's in session for us to identify that as an abusive tax shelter. There are things that the federal government should be identifying, and there's legislation to identify that they never do, like taking the Nike swoosh and putting it in a business that's owned in the Netherlands, and then every time it's used, you pay a piece of the profit to the Netherlands, and it doesn't get taxed. Well, the states might decide to get strong and say, you know what? This isn't okay. And Oregon wouldn't be able to go along with it unless they come back to the legislature where the decisions are made by people who really haven't used abusive tax shelters and don't know them, being influenced by people who are defending people who have used abusive tax shelters. And I think that people within the department are much more knowledgeable about what needs to happen, and they have the contacts with other parts of the tax community that knows what needs to be there. I would suggest, rather than moving Senate Bill 39, you use the words that left your house last session. They are the words about abusive tax shelters that are in House Bill 2747, that you not tinker with those words, except to remove the voluntary compliance initiative portion of the legislation. There are other items in that bill that you could choose to not move on at all because they're about all sorts of other issues and just take the abusive tax shelter language. But that language has not been played with by the foxes. And I think you want a hen house that's strong. Thank you.
Thank you. I know you have... watch it. I don't want to use an animal analogy. Certainly watched this issue for years. Questions for Jody? Senator George.
Just really quickly, I'm reading from some testimony received earlier. I'm going to just read you the quotes. Most of the California VCI collections were from personal rather than corporate taxes. And then he said approximately 70% of the corporate receipts were from 2000-2002 rather than earlier years. Are we chasing something in the past that was probably accepted by government, and now we're going to go back and put a penalty on them when it appears that that may not be a substantial amount of money and the cost may be high to pursue it?
Senator George, I have here in a graph that you can, where you can see what the corporate percentages are compared to the personal percentages, that all the way through the years, most of it was personal. It's a lot of tax fraud is done by people who sell their company and now they owe taxes on $35 million and they don't want to pay it. And they get advice from bankers and accountants and lawyers that say, here's an idea. Oh, well, you can do this, this, and this, and you won't have to pay taxes. And they pay $1 million for that advice or $400,000 for that advice. So, yes, it's both. It's basically people who have been in corporations or people who are in corporations. It's the corporations or it's the owners of corporations that tend to use abusive tax shelters because they're the ones with large amounts of money. In California, the average taxpayer paid $1.2 million in state taxes. So you can, and their tax structure is roughly the same as ours. So you can see that they were sheltering large amounts of income from taxation. But I'd be happy to share this with you.
Other questions for Ms. Weiser? Thank you, Jody. closed work session on 39. Cinema Row, you're driving that train, whether you like it or not. Open a work session on Senate Bill 38. We got to get through a few people because they've been waiting for a while. Yes, the miners want to talk to us briefly. Russ, you want to?
I'll just make one brief comment.
Okay. Or Dr. Bandera, please. Yeah, as long as they're still shuttling their papers.
Okay, let me be very brief. Senator Decker and members of the committee, my name is Russ Dondero. I live at 1506 Olympus Lane in Forest Grove, Oregon. Have done so since 1974. I've submitted testimony to you during the first hearing that looks like this, plus some supplementary documents which each of you have. I also did another document which you have on the record, and I'll let you read that at your leisure. But the main thing I want to respond to was a question that came up toward the end of the last hearing, and that was, are there other states that use this vehicle of a document recording fee to support affordable housing? And the answer is yes. The states are Delaware, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Missouri, Ohio, and the state of Washington. And the state of Washington program has been in effect since 1987. And I have a document which is in your packet. This document shows you the success they've had in building over 26,000 affordable housing units with their system since that time. And so I just leave that for the record, and thank you.
It's important to note from the last hearing that we had. Thank you, Darrow. Yes, the mining community.
Some of my copies are being made.
Chair Deckert and members of the committee, we just got an amendment from LC.
I just need to get your name and
Tom Quintel. I'm a citizen and I'm not used to this type of thing, so bear with me if you can. Unfortunately, you don't have the information to look at while I give my brief testimony, and so that I don't get off on track here, I think I'll read it to you rather than...
We're only up against the clock, or I would be more than happy to have you read it.
It's real quick.
Okay.
I can
okay.
read it fast. Chairman Decker, member of the committee, my name is Tom Quintel, resident of Salem, Oregon, and I am a small-scale miner with multiple mining claims in Oregon. And I want to thank you, Senator Decker, for allowing the miners to be heard at this work session. As a native Oregonian for 66 years and a citizen of the U.S. and an active taxpayer, I respectfully request Senate Bill 38 to be declared a bill with a no vote by the Senate and Finance Revenue Committee. This bill needs to go before the Oregon voters to stand on its own merits. This is just another way to keep Oregon residents from voting on a tax measure. And I also object to Senate Bill 38 that requires county clerks to become tax collectors for the Oregon Department of Revenue, with proposed amendments included in Senate Bill 38. As a small-scale miner with multiple mining claims in Oregon, I am required by federal and state laws to pay an annual recording fee at the county clerk's office to protect and defend my personal property, that being my mineral rights, to avoid forfeiting my mining claims. This new proposed tax and Senate Bill 38 discriminates against Oregon miners due to the required annual filing. We small claim owners of Oregon seek relief from Senate Bill 38 proposed tax. If the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee does vote to pass Senate Bill 38 on to Ways and Means, or for a vote to the Senate floor, the mineral claim owners respectfully request our amendment to be added to Senate Bill 38, and that's Amendment C, instruments required under ORS 517-210 to maintain a mining claim. This amendment was given to Legislative Council on March of 13th. One of the other things that maybe you are or are not aware of, the legislative session now is holding hearings on two additional tax bills requiring county clerks to charge additional recording tax and pending hearing and a vote. House Bill 2085 for an additional dollar per page recording fee, and House Bill 2857 for $3 per page recording tax. Both of these bills will cause an additional hardship to our small business regarding small-scale miners in Oregon. And then in 1999, additional $11 tax was added to record a document at the county clerk's office. This has highly impacted our annual recording for proof of labor affidavit. And for some reason, apparently they're using the clerks to become a tax collector. And so we object to it and appreciate whatever you can do to help us. And it's a matter of equity and fairness for us. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Yes, and thank you for your amendments are not out of council.
They are. In fact, you should have a copy of them.
We've got more paper than we know what to do with right now.
Four amendments, I think.
It's a very simple amendment.
It just takes mining equipment out of...
Not mining equipment. It has nothing to do with mining equipment. It's the proof of labor. We have to file by federal and state statute. And all we're asking is that amendment be included if you pass this bill so that we aren't tagged with an additional $15 tax because we're required by law to do this every year. We don't have a choice. It's not an option for us. This is something that's mandated by current law. And if you get married, do a real estate transaction, quick claim deed, those are optional. You don't have to do it. We do. Or we lose our mineral right. We lose our claim. It becomes null and void. So this is highly impacting our activity, and that's why we're concerned about it.
Thank you. My wife did not, she was clear, was not optional on the marriage piece, but I understand understand your point.
So that's our concern. In a nutshell.
Appreciate that. And you did great.
I appreciate it.
Not easy to sometimes come into your state capitol, and you figured out the amendment process, got it on time. questions for Mr. Quintel. And Mr. Messersmith?
I'll
associate yourself with those comments.
Yes, I do.
And Mr. Kitchar, associate yourself with those comments.
Yes.
Or wish to add a few more.
If I may.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. My name is Tom Kitcher. I'm president of the Waldo Mining District. We were established in 1852, slightly before statehood. The issue to us basically boils down to, is this fee in SB 38 as applied to the annual required filing of affidavits of labor or payment of the maintenance fee, is it a fee or is it a tax? In some of the papers I handed out to you, I have a four-page arguments for amending SB 38. Starting on page two of that, just yesterday, I found two Oregon Supreme Court cases that dealt with fee versus tax. In both of those cases, I don't have the right word for these people. I haven't slept in about 25 hours. The people of the cities that brought the suits lost in both cases. Their situations were the exact opposite of what the miners are facing. As Mr. Quintel stated, mining claim owners, and I believe we are the only type or class of citizen in the state of Oregon that are required by law, federal and state law, to annually file these affidavits as a prerequisite to owning our property. Now, mining claims are considered real property under state and federal law. And yet, a provision of keeping that property is this annual filing. We don't have a choice, as he stated. If we fail to file, we lose the claim. It becomes open to relocation by anybody. It'd be that you own your house. If you fail to file a piece of paper, your house is gone. Somebody else could move in. There is a provision in Oregon law, ORS 307.080, states that mining claims are exempt from taxation. Now, we're talking about the claim itself, not improvements, not equipment, not a dwelling or anything like that, but the actual claim itself is exempt from taxation. If you look at the The definition in the Oregon Constitution of a tax is any charge imposed by a governmental unit upon property or upon a property owner as a direct consequence of ownership of that property. That's what we got here. We can only keep our property if we file this piece of paper. The added $15
has nothing to do with the recording fees.
Is basically we believe this is a tax. A simple amendment that we've written. It would just add that line C, instruments required under ORS 517.210 to maintain mining claims, mm-hmm. would exempt that portion. Now, the miners are still not going to get off scot-free. We still have to pay to record notices of location when we locate a new claim, or if we purchase a claim from somebody, we have to file a quick claim deed. We would pay whatever fees are set on those documents, because those are voluntary one-time filings. It's only this annual assessments that we are really concerned with, because it places a really undue hard burden on the mining claim owners. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you journeying to the Capitol today. Questions for this panel? If you could meet with the advocates of this bill and just talk to them about, and I'll make sure that y'all connect. If you're going to be around after this hearing, that'd be great.
Sure.
Don't want to use up too much of your time. I know you probably have other places to be this afternoon.
My time is yours at this point.
They drove a long distance here.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. I'm sure they did. That's why I want to be.
Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, according to my notes, this is a $63 million tax increase.
That's correct.
Thank you very much. Appreciate.
Thank you.
Any county clerks, you signed up. Do you want to testify one more time?
Sure.
Do you have anything new to add we are up against the clock? Any new information?
Really quick.
Please.
Chair Decker, members of the committee, James Morales, representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks, and Jan Coleman, also representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. Just wanted to reiterate, real quick, emphasize that we see this as a tax and not a fee. Also, by slipping it under the Assessment and Taxation Fund, a fund with dedicated purposes, outlined and defined I gave you a written testimony as well, but it's outlined. I've given it to you. It's ORS 294-175 as well as 294-184, that this assessment and taxation fund has purposes for which to be expended, defined in statute. The bill does not change those definitions of how these funds will be spent, but it does change a distribution of those funds outside of the defined uses. And so we submit it's a tax, and it's being placed in a fund outside of the defined uses of that fund. Jan also has something to add real quick.
Basically, Chair Deckert and members of the committee, I'm Jan Coleman, Yamhill County Clerk. Also representing Oregon Association of County Clerks today. Because it has come to the point where we feel like the train left the depot and we're running to catch up, because no one ever really contacted us in the process here, which, you know, we've always been taught that that's part of etiquette, is to contact the players. And since we are the frontline player, we feel like we should have been contacted. Anyway, we have a proposed amendment here that we are submitting. And we feel that we are having costs here and so forth, that this has been erroneously placed in the ANT statute. So we're amending it that because of our fiscal, we should get the 5% as the law provides. And we are also amending that this should go into a separate fund, not into the ANT fund, because the ANT fund is not for housing. as defined in statute.
Great. And you've had your amendment drafted, or are still waiting to do that?
Still waiting to do. I just did this last night, so I've got to do that.
Sure. If you need help drafting it, we're going to hold off on moving this. But the intent, I believe, is to move it, just so you know. And I think there will be objections to that, but I think the intent is to move it. But would be happy to entertain your amendments.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Close. Anyone else on Senate Bill 38? Oh, I'm sorry, Victor. Yes, you've been waiting. Well, we're supposed to be on the floor creating a rainy day fund here in a moment. And I apologize. You've been...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Victor Merced, Director of Oregon Housing and Community Development. If you'd like, I could come back at another time. What I wanted to do was to talk about the processes internally mm-hmm. in the agency for the distribution of these resources, and then we wanted to talk a little bit about the governor's budget and how this intersects with some of our priorities. So that's a little bit longer than I think the time that we have, so I'd be happy to come back and do that presentation for the committee at another time.
We should do it when we reschedule. I've been requested to recess, but Paul, I don't know how we do that given that it's 10:30 now, and the House Revenue Committee needs this hearing room at 1. We're going to be on the floor and doing things until 1.
The only time would be after the tree.
Yeah. This room's free after 3? Okay, and I'll get back to the members. We'll go ahead and recess until 3. Except for I hate to do this to folks like the miners who've driven a long way and just keep you here till 3. So I think what I'll do is just adjourn, and then we can reschedule so that folks don't sit around waiting for this committee to reconvene that aren't otherwise in the building. Okay, so we will close work session on 38 and adjourn the Senate Revenue and Finance Committee, Finance and Revenue.